Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, what is really happening in Venezuela and the U.S.-supported coup currently underway. Two guests today in the second part of our program, Greg Pallast, well-known investigative journalist, will be here because he also was a friend of Hugo Chavez and is familiar with the dealings to get Venezuela oil. He believes that's going to be one of the main reasons for the coup. Joining us now, however, is Professor William Robinson from Santa Barbara, California. He is professor of sociology, as well as Latin American studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's also a university faculty member in its Global and International Studies program. He's a scholar, activist, deeply involved in third world struggles for social justice. In Latin America, he has looked at all different parties and is asking a basic question. Why is there not peace? Why is there not equality? Why is there so much carnage? And he also has looked at participatory democracy and the environment. He's interested in how popular empowerment movements by the people can get some strength. His areas of focus include globalization, transnationalism, political economics, immigration, and a variety of sociological issues. He received his graduate degrees from the University of New Mexico, and his articles appear in Global Research, and he has published 9 books, his latest being Into the Tempest, Essays on the New Global Capitalism. His earlier work, Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity, takes a hard look at the totalitarian structures and agenda of the transnational capitalist class that promotes neoliberal restructuring and trade liberalization. Nice to have you with us today, William.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me back on, Gary.
We can go back to March 2015 when President Obama signed an executive order for imposing sanctions against Venezuela not long after the death of Hugo Chavez and his successor coming to power in a democratic election. The White House's wording in the order states that the U.S. was, quote, declaring a national emergency with respect to the unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, meaning America's national security, and foreign policy of the United States posed by the situation in Venezuela. Now, as we know, after sanctions were imposed, Venezuela for years was destabilized with rampant food shortages, rioting, and looting. Then again, in July of 2017, shortly after coming into power, Trump posed even more new sanctions. But I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. I would like, please, for you to start with President Obama and Hillary Clinton, because she was Secretary of the State. And what evidence is there that would warrant the United States government's statement that Venezuela posed any threat to the United States national security other than the governments of Chavez and the current president, Maduro? They're socialist. And can you share some of the history behind the animosity of previous presidents since Hugo Chavez won the presidency in 1999? The forum is yours.
Right. Well, you're absolutely right to identify 2015 as an important date because it represents an intensification of the U.S. campaign to destabilize the Venezuelan revolution and overthrow the government, the revolutionary government of Venezuela. But as you correctly noted, the story really has to go back to 1999. We're in the 20-year anniversary of an all-out U.S. destabilization campaign, which began shortly after Hugo Chavez won democratic elections in 1998. He took office in 1999, and almost immediately U.S. aggression began. And the first round of this aggression culminated, your listeners will remember, in 2002, when there was a coup d'etat. It lasted about 48 hours, a little more than 48 hours. Population massively came out to reverse that coup d'etat. But it later was revealed that the United States was involved in and supported that coup d'etat. And so after 2002, the United States continued its hostility towards Venezuela during all of the Bush years and during the Obama years. But as you correctly noted, in 2015, there was an escalation of that aggression with the imposition of much more severe sanctions against Venezuela. You ask, and then in 2017, Trump comes in and continues this policy. This is both a Democratic and Republican policy. And by the way, in parentheses, let me say that the position of the U.S. Democratic Party over the last week of this crisis with Venezuela has been absolutely disgusting, except for a handful of exceptions. The U.S. establishment, Democratic and Republican, has lined up behind this aggression towards Venezuela. But you ask what threat Venezuela poses to the United States that would warrant a national emergency. Of course, none whatsoever. And everyone listening to this broadcast and not listening to knows that the real story here simply is, above anything else, oil. Venezuela has the largest oil deposits in the world, more than the Soviet, more than Russia, more than Saudi Arabia, more than the United States. And not just that, but Venezuela is set to take over the presidency of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. And what is Venezuela going to do there besides representing the interests of oil producers, particularly from the third world? More significantly, Venezuela is going to push for payments in non-dollar currencies for oil. And that's very important because it means the United States cannot control the global oil market because of its control over the dollar and the dollar supply. It also means that Venezuela can get around this financial blockade. This is killing Venezuela, the U.S. financial blockade, together with all of its other forms of aggression. So let's look at this for a moment. It is true that Venezuela is in a very deep economic crisis, a political crisis, and a social crisis. That cannot be denied, nor can it be denied that part of that crisis has been generated by the government's own mismanagement, by toleration of corruption and other problems internal to Venezuela and the Venezuelan government. But the biggest explanation for this unbelievable crisis that the Venezuelan people are suffering is two factors that come together. One is the global economy. Venezuela has no other alternative but to integrate into world markets, into the global economy, and that global economy is controlled by transnational corporate capital and also by the powerful countries led by the United States. And Venezuela has been completely dependent on oil. It has not been able to break that oil dependency. And so that means that when oil prices dropped precipitously, 2013, 14, 15, and 16, it threw the Venezuelan economy and society into a tailspin, and the United States was able to use that to intensify its destabilization efforts. And the second reason Venezuela is in such a difficult crisis, beyond that is way more significantly than the government's own mistakes, is the U.S. aggression. And part of that U.S. aggression, as you just mentioned, is, first of all, the 2015 sanctions, and then these latest sanctions just last week. And what this means is that Venezuela exports 40% of its oil to the United States, and that goes to its subsidiary, Citgo, in the United States. And Venezuela cannot, the profits that Citgo makes and all of that oil money, because of the U.S. financial blockade, cannot be sent back to Venezuela. So this is what's behind the terrible crisis in Venezuela. And again, the only threat to the United, not to the people of the United States, the poor and working people of the United States, the threat that Venezuela represents is to transnational corporate interests, including the oil conglomerate interests. And I'll just add one other thing in this response. The Venezuelan situation has to be seen in light of the larger Latin American situation. And the region turned to the left, starting with Venezuela in 1999 and throughout the first part of the first decade of the 21st century. It's known as the Pink Tide. There was also revolutions, or certainly the rise to power of leftist governments in Bolivia, in Ecuador, in Central America, in Argentina, in Brazil, etc. And this was a tremendous threat to the historic traditional domination of the United States in Latin America. And it was also a threat, less so, I would have liked to see it be more of a threat, but to transnational corporate interests in the region. And so the far right in worldwide, led by the United States and in Latin America, went on the counteroffensive starting in the last few years to recapture power in the region for the far right. And they have been successful in Brazil. They've been successful in Argentina. They've been successful in Chile and elsewhere. But Venezuela has been the very epicenter of that turn to the left in the region. So this campaign against Venezuela is an attempt to turn back the entire progressive agenda in all of Latin America, and for that matter, the Third World, not just Venezuela. So that's the larger significance also of what is going on.
I'm afraid that what we're witnessing might be a repeat of what happened in Libya. Before NATO's military intervention to oust Gaddafi, again, he was not killing his own citizens. That was all, as it turned out. And we have complete evidence now that was a setup, a regime change. Libya was the economic jewel of Africa. Likewise, before Hugo Chavez came to office, Venezuela was one of the poorest countries in Latin America and ruled by an autocratic elite with ties to the U.S. Chavez's revolution, in fact, did wonders for the Venezuelan people, even though he held an anti-globalization position, which has been common in Latin American countries, including Central America, where socialist governments have emerged and fallen over the decades. So when you look at Hugo Chavez and you look at what he did for the poor people, because if you were wealthy and you were part of the ruling elite, you had the largest states, you could shop anywhere in the world, you could take private jets. But if you were the average person, you were not educated, you were illiterate, you were very poor, and you were hungry. And the first thing he did was he started food cooperatives. He subsidized people's foods. He gave them free education. He set up all these schools, and he started a land redistribution program. And he would not then allow the former ruling oligarchs to have anything to do with the oil company. And he did more to lift the country up out of poverty and help the poorest than any president they had ever had. In fact, he is a remarkable case example of what can happen in a populist movement. Then the price of oil fell from around $115 a barrel, more or less, down into the 30s. And then they no longer had the cash flow. And what I'm seeing in the American media, and I'd like for you to address this too also, I'm seeing both the left and the right, MSNBC, CNN, The New York Times, Washington Post, all the mainstream media are all looking at Venezuela and supporting that something has to be done without taking into account any of the things we just mentioned or how history could be repeating itself from Libya to Venezuela, and that John Bolton, the one person in the United States that really deserves the title of super hawk on steroids, this man seems to be hermetically sealed at the intellectual level that the only regime is one that we can change and control, and how Trump could surround himself with militant militarists and neoliberalist and globalist, it's just, it defies reason. But the media are smarter than Trump. In fact, just about any reporter in America is smarter than Trump. So I'm very concerned about the media. I'm very concerned of what the media is doing to show its hand right now. I believe there's actually a coup going on in the United States. And in one respect, I'm glad it's happening, because for those of us who have been progressive or on the left for decades, we've seen this. We didn't trust J. Edgar Hoover. We didn't trust the Senate. We didn't trust the attorney generals, Ed Meese, or any of them, because, with the exception of Ramsey Clark, because we knew they were substantially compromised and there to protect the elite and those in power. Now, the very people who at one time would rail against corruption, Operation COINTELPRO, these are the very people supporting the FBI, supporting Mueller, supporting the CIA, supporting people that perjured themselves before Congress. So these are the people who are going to tell us that everything Venezuela is due to a socialist regime and Maduro's corruption? No, I'm not buying that Not 1 second. I'd like your very measured thoughts, please.
Yes, well, you're hitting on really all of the critical issues at play here. You pointed out that the Venezuelan Revolution massively redistributed wealth and power downward to the poor majority. That, of course, is a threat to elite interests, not just in Venezuela, but everywhere. It shows that a revolution, and not even a revolution, simply a progressive agenda of recovering natural resources and policy for the poor can have tremendous effects. And, you know, it's no wonder that in Venezuela, the elite opposition is seen by the population as just that, an elite opposition that wants to go back to the past. It is true that there's mass disaffection in Venezuela because of the crisis and also because of government mismanagement, but that has not translated into mass support for the elite opposition. And that's been a problem for the U.S. Program of destabilization right from the start. You mentioned Libya, and that's a very real danger that we can see the Libya outcome in Venezuela. But I think a scarier parallel would be the Syrianization of Venezuela, because if there is not some type of a political or negotiated solution, and if the U.S. does not back off and continues to push this, Venezuela is moving towards a path of civil war. And that civil war is not going to, it's going to be a horrible situation for Venezuelans, for all of Latin America. It's going to be something like a Syrianization. But I want to point out also in this regard that this elite opposition in Venezuela, backed fully and instigated by the United States, is an extremely violent opposition. This notion that this is a democratic opposition that the United States is now recognizing as a government is absolutely absurd. It's nonsensical. You pointed out that this is an opposition that tiny minority leads the opposition, that controlled the country's wealth historically and left the majority impoverished. But we have to add to that, it's also been always an extremely repressive and violent opposition, constantly provoking violence, constantly provoking retaliation from the government. And let's remember something else also, that this crisis has been generated by Washington in yet another sense, because there were elections in Venezuela in May of 2018. The United States and all of its allies, including the Democrats in the United States, is saying that it's an illegitimate government. It wasn't elected in free and fair elections, but they were technically free and fair elections. They most certainly were. There were 16 opposition candidates that participated. But what happened is that in 2017 and early 2018, leading up to those May elections of last year, Spain and other European governments sponsored negotiations between the opposition and the current government of Maduro to participate in those elections and have, therefore, a reconciliation through the electoral process. The opposition was going to participate, and Washington pressured the opposition to pull out and boycott the elections. That happened in February of last year, 2019. Therefore, the main opposition, big elite opposition groups, did not participate in the May elections as an intentional strategy to try and delegitimize them. That's what Washington wanted. That's what Washington pushed for. And that's why Washington now is trying to claim, therefore, that Maduro is not a legitimately elected president. He most certainly is. And, you know, it's no wonder, Gary, that Guaido, this person who they're saying is now the new transition president, he's already announced that his first measures are to seek a loan from the International Monetary Fund. And we know that loans from the IMF means that you impose austerity on the mass of the population that are plundered into poverty and marginality. And secondly, he said one of his first measures is he's going to reprivatize oil. So it's very clear what the agenda of this far right wing elite opposition is, backed again by the United States. But you're also you were mentioning Bolton. I could not agree with you more that he's a crazed, dangerous maniac. But it's really, there's a cabal of several key players from the United States. I mean, you have to include Trump there. But you have John Bolton. You have Marco Rubio, the far right wing senator who's mobilizing the right wing forces from Florida. You have Pompeo, Secretary of State Pompeo. And you have the vice president, Mike Pence. So this is really the cabal of criminals in Washington that's pushing this confrontation with Venezuela. And then finally, you were also mentioning the media, both the left and the right. It's really pathetic what's happening here in the United States. There are voices on the left and the progressive community calling for non-intervention. That is true. But as I mentioned previously, except for a handful of Congress members or representatives from the U.S. Democratic Party, they're all on board. So, I mean, it's showing to me this pathetic situation where the whole U.S. establishment is imperialist, interventionist, and defending corporate interests outside U.S. borders, even if they are progressive on social or political issues inside U.S. borders. And yes, the media is jumping on the bandwagon, of, as a matter of course. And yes, also, I think you're absolutely right to point out that why are we turning to the FBI and the CIA, which is, by the way, involved in all of this destabilization abroad, intimately involved in it, as if they're the saviors for this Trump nightmare that, we are facing.
How much of the demise of Venezuela's social structure and economy can be contributed to interference by the United States and any of our other allies?
Well, great question. We have to see it as synergistic, that there's, that each factor plays off the other. So the United States is waging in Venezuela what I've called in my previous research, because they did the same thing in Central America and elsewhere, such as in Chile before them. It's waging a war of attrition. So what the United States has been doing is economic aggression, including the most recent severe financial sanctions, financial blockade, military aggression, such as promoting the 2002 coup d'etat, a media blackout internationally, diplomatic aggression, economic sabotage inside the country, even supporting military sabotage units inside the country, boycotting the elections. All of this is meant to wear down the revolution. It's meant to create an economic crisis inside the country that would lead, of course, to social crisis and political crisis. And that's the, that's known as the strategy of the war of attrition. Now, I mentioned previously, and I want to reiterate this, because I am 100% against all U.S. intervention. And for that matter, anybody in their right mind has to support the Maduro government in resisting this gross violation of any international laws or norms. But having said that, also the Venezuelan government has made a lot of errors, including mismanagement of the currency, including, again, tolerating too much corruption, including not doing enough to break the dependency on oil. So, but the United States war of attrition strategy has been to take advantage of Venezuelan government's own errors to intensify the crisis. So that's the second. That's how those two things come together. And then the third thing in the background, again, is that every time a poor third world country has tried to change things around internally in favor of the poor majority, it's had to run up, and this is the thing, this is in Cuba too, as we speak. It has to run up against the fact that there is a single global capitalist world economy right now, and you have no choice but to participate in it. When you do, you have all kinds of external global economic influences that try that work to undermine your ability to transform things at home. So you mentioned the precipitous drop in oil prices. Venezuela cannot control the global oil market. And so it has no choice but to accept those lower prices. Venezuela tried to have currency controls so that you could still import mass consumption goods for people that didn't have a lot of dollars. And that was a good measure internally in Venezuela. But because there's a single world financial market now, that could not be sustained. And that helped spark hyperinflation. So all of these things come together. Just to recap, U.S. intervention drives the whole thing. You have the government's own mistake. And then you have the restrictions and limitations that the whole global capitalist economy imposes. And three of them come together to create this crisis in Venezuela.
The presidential elections that you mentioned were held back in May of 2018. Mm-hmm. We're told that Maduro won by two-thirds of the vote. At the time the elections took place, they were declared, as you mentioned, fair, but also peaceful and transparent. Only mm-hmm. now are we witnessing the opposition and its leader, Juan Guaido, making claims of being the legitimate president. How could a person that wasn't in that, didn't win the vote, suddenly he's being declared by all of the now right-wing governments in Central and South America, in the United States, I think Great Britain, as the legitimate president. Also, Germany and France and Great Britain and the United States are giving Maduro a time limit to get out of the, you know, get out of the presidency.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I mean, my God, this is much like telling Saddam Hussein, you've got 24 hours to leave your country, your own sovereign nation, or we're going to destroy it, and you with it. And it brings to mind three areas I'd like you to address. The first is, you mentioned that they are a part of a world economy. Yes. And Richard Gale, and you know Richard, Richard and I spent almost 6 months collecting official figures because I knew what we were being told were lies. And all the media, with all their resources, New York Times, have all been participating in passing on this lies. Now, whether they're aware that these are lies, and maybe they're not, and I'll hold off judgment. But nonetheless, we've been told nothing but lies about other countries' debts compared to the gross domestic product and our unemployment levels. And why is this important? Because this brings me to the second part of this equation. The United States, based upon the best official figures we could find, we have right now close to $200 trillion in debt, including unfunded or partially funded or non-funded liabilities and entitlements. That includes corporate debt, which is in the trillions of dollars, mortgage debt, car loan debt, credit card debt, state debts, local government debts, the federal government's actual on-the-books debts and off-the-book, all told at $77 trillion. Now, when you look at our gross domestic product of between $20 to $21 trillion, we then become the number one indebted nation in the world compared to our gross domestic product. We're at 1,200%. And we're told that it's all only 100%. That's wrong. And then we thought Greece was a basket case at 250%. So on the one hand, we cannot tell the truth. If the word gets out and enough people, including economists who must know this, they have teams of economists who can study these figures as we have, you're dealing with the fact that the United States is completely, totally bankrupt. Totally bankrupt. No way in the world we'll ever get out of this. And then you ask, well, how then do we not go down? Simple. You mentioned it. The world exchange currency is principally the dollar. There are some mixed currencies, but we're the dominant one. And when countries like Libya and other African nations were going to stop using the dollar and use the gold denier for their exchanging in oil, so right now Russia and China are no longer using the dollar. India and China and Russia are no longer using the dollar. Other countries are giving up the dollar and using other currencies, including gold. So if everyone's got gold, like Russia and China, tons of it, backing up their currencies, and we have nothing backing up our currency, we have a fiat currency, then the moment there is an international agreement to switch to a mixed currency, the dollar that's already lost about 95% of its value since 1900, it will just drop like a lead balloon, and our entire economy will crash overnight. It will never recover. And people who think it's bad from 2008 till 2015, that is nothing compared to what will happen when the dollar is no longer the dynamic currency that we have had. I'd like for you to address those issues. And also, we said we had 3.8, then 4% unemployment. My goodness, we had 96 million Americans who at one time worked full-time, could still work full-time, and were unemployed or partly employed. That meant that the actual unemployment level in the United States was 22 to 28%. And yet, we never talk about those figures. Now, if I can find these figures, everyone else can find them also. Why is it that academia, why is it that the media, the economists, the government officials, no one's telling us the truth about any of these figures showing we're bankrupt, we're completely dead in the water when it comes to our future economically, and no one discusses this?
Of course. Well, the media, the political power elite, and the corporate elite control the flow of information and images, and that's majority of people are informed by that, not by the actual data, accurate data that you're presenting. But let me briefly answer the two big issues you raised. Start going back to Venezuela and Guaido. Guaido is someone with no legitimacy whatsoever outside of being propped up by the United States. He's a member of the Voluntad Popular Party, the Popular Will Party, which is one of these far-right-wing parties that boycotted the elections. They actually do not have a majority in the National Assembly, but they usurped a majority. There's no time to go into detail how they did that. But simply, the parties in the National Assembly rotate who's going to be the president of the National Assembly. Guaido, representing his Popular Will Party, rotated in just a couple weeks ago. And with that, he then declared, because the Constitution says if the president can't serve, then the head of the National Assembly will serve. And then he was contacted by Washington. This is the unbelievable thing. It's from outside to say, now declare yourself interim president and we're going to recognize you. He's been just talking, literally talking by phone with Trump and Pompeo and all of them on a daily basis. So he has no legitimacy whatsoever. What he has is the backing of the most powerful country on the world and this world, the all these world capitalist powers that you mentioned, Germany, England, and of course the right-wing governments in Latin America, which have organized into what they call the Lima Group to be this right-wing bloc. That's where his legitimacy comes from. External counter-revolution, not from any internal legitimacy. But turning to the what you're saying, you're absolutely right in your analysis of the U.S. Political economy. The U.S., but also the global, I would just add, because the U.S. political economy is so central to the whole global economy, you can't separate it. It's totally unsustainable. And it is driven by, above all, what you just correctly identified, debt. Secondly, it's driven by wild speculation throughout the global casino, led by the United States, which has led to one bubble after another. And third, remember, it's also driven by what I call militarized accumulation, militarizing the global economy, creating a global war economy. And these three things have sustained the U.S. economy and prevented it from collapsing to date. But as you pointed out, it's totally unsustainable. And another world recession is coming, and it's not far-fetched at all that another massive collapse is coming. And that's also why we are seeing, because of the potential for a global economic collapse, the unsustainability of the U.S.-led global economic model, and because also there's this incredible social polarization worldwide. You mentioned the real unemployment rate in the United States, but you also need to mention that when these elites brag that there's only 3.8% unemployment, they don't include that those who are employed are precariously employed, and they're employed at close to poverty wages. So my fear, though, is that when the U.S. economy crashes, it's going to take the world with it. And that's going to give a boost, hopefully, to leftist and progressive forces to take the initiative. But more scary, it's going to give a bigger boost also to 21st century fascist forces in the face of a U.S. and world economic collapse.
Greg Pallas is on the line now, but I have one final question for you before we go to Greg. In recent years, I believe we're witnessing an enormous shift towards the Trumpification of Latin America. Politics have dramatically steered to the right. It seems like only Morales in Bolivia holds the old popular socialist mantle on the continent. Ecuador's Moreno quickly shifted away from his original populist stance by turning right and opposing Carrera's socialist progress. Brazil now has an extreme totalitarian leader in Bolsonaro. Chile and Argentina elected business moguls, turned right-wing politicians several years ago. All of these administrations are aligned with the U.S.'s capitalist globalization efforts. Now, the same might happen in Venezuela. In the broader picture, why are we seeing this dramatic shift towards the right and elite class across Latin America? And how much of this has to do with Latin America's need for access to global capital controlled by the Western nations?
Absolutely. Well, that's the principal factor in my analysis. And I was talking previously, we were talking about the global oil markets that oil producers such as Venezuela don't control, and then the dependence on dollars. So that is a big factor. But I don't want the left in Latin America to get off the hook. There are legitimate criticisms. We can support the left. We can vehemently oppose U.S. intervention and imperialism, which I do, of course. But we also need to see that the leftist governments could have taken more significant measures to break free of U.S. economic control and transnational corporate control. In these different countries, there was too much of an emphasis on what's criticized by the left in Latin America as extractivism, too much emphasis on simply expanding the soy soy plantations for export, expanding oil and natural gas output, and all of that meant that this expansion of extractivism made the region more dependent on the global economy and those that control the levers of the global economy. And when the poor and workers and peasants insisted to their leftist governments, supporting them, but insisting to them, we need deeper transformation, the leftist government said, no, we can't. We're going to push forward this extractivist model. So I think that the secondary factor is the left's own mistakes and the people and the forces that control the global economy and the global power structure were able to take advantage of those mistakes to push forward a regional counter-revolution that has swept the far right back into power. That's the moment we're at now. But the region is in deep crisis. The right is in power, but its hold on power is very tenuous. Anything could happen at this point. We're in a critical conjuncture, and the future is really wide open.
I very much appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights with us today. Thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Professor William Robinson, Professor of Sociology and Latin American Studies, University of California, Santa Barbara. Now we're going over and say hello to our other guest who's standing by, a good friend of the program, Greg Palast. He is a journalist whose news-breaking stories appear on BBC Television, The Guardian, Rolling Stone magazine. The British Tribune has called Greg the most important investigative journalist in our time. He's produced dozens of films for BBC Newsnight and has won many awards, including the Financial Times, National Press Club, and George Orwell Courage in Journalism Awards. And he broke many important stories, including the official story behind the Exxon Valdez, civil racketeering behind the Shoreham nuclear plant, the purging of votes in Florida during the Bush-Gore election, vulture funds, the Deep Horizon oil spill, and more recently, voter fraud during the past two presidential elections. And he directed the recent film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which follows Donald Trump's wildest claims based on his New York Times best-selling books, including Armed Madhouse. Greg holds an MBA in finance from the University of Chicago. His website is gregpalast.com. Nice to have you with us today, Greg.
Glad to be with you, and I'd like to remind people from way back, I was the main reporter covering Venezuela for BBC Television Newsnight and for The Guardian newspapers. That was so Venezuela and Chavez, and when Hugo Chavez was president, and I was there quite a bit. And so I was deep in that. In fact, I've just put out on at gregpalast.com, you can actually download without charge my film for BBC Television, The Assassination of Hugo Chavez. And it may give you a better idea what's going on there.
Well, then that ties directly into what I was going to ask you, and that is that the big news yesterday was that Trump has hit Venezuela's major national oil company with very harsh sanctions. And this is all part of the U.S. and its allies' efforts, notably the United Kingdom, but also now Colombia and Brazil, to oust Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro. And we might remember that 95% of Venezuela's export is oil, which makes up about 25% of its gross domestic product. So this goes to the very heart of the country with a clear intention to further destabilize everything into chaos. And there are three main areas I'd like you to speak on, please. Okay. Venezuela oil and the role of Venezuela has played during the Chavez years in the oil market. Then corruption. And then finally, how is the United States orchestrating a coup to bring down Maduro and install its puppet? You personally knew Hugo Chavez and had once interviewed him in the presidential palace. So first, give us your personal account of the man as a leader, the social revolution he launched, and his accomplishments. And because, although Chavez was a nuisance, I should say, to the United States, he managed to keep the Venezuela economy growing and improve human conditions for a long time. It wasn't until his successor, Maduro, came to office that things began to unravel. So the forum is yours.
Okay. Well, actually, I interviewed Hugo Chavez many times in his presidential palace, including right after he was kidnapped with another U.S.-directed, literally, coup d'etat, where they kidnapped Chavez. And coup leaders took over the the presidential palace, and they did exactly what they're doing here. They had a self-declared president, which the U.S. recognized right away, and then a million people marched down to the center of the city, and Air Force commandos were actually underneath the presidential palace, and suddenly the coup leaders, the great all of civil society, as they called themselves, the great leaders. And white, this is very important, very white people took back control. So we see basically a repeat of what happened there, except now they're smarter. They're going to kill people if they try to rise up and prevent this coup d'etat. And they're strangling the country, the U.S. and Big Oil and Big Oil's friends. Don't forget, Canada is also an oil-controlled nation. And that's the real question to ask. You know, is one question when you have to ask what's going on in Venezuela, you have to ask a single question. Gee, is there happen to be a lot of oil there? Venezuela, according to OPEC, Venezuela, not Saudi Arabia, has the world's biggest reserves of oil, super heavy crude, with oil reserves about three times that of Saudi Arabia. That's the prize. Both two ways. One is taking it when they need it, but also keeping it in the ground to make sure it doesn't flood the market when they don't want it. The last thing you want is a leftist in control of this massive, massive source of oil. You notice we're not talking about the we're suddenly concerned about democracy, not in Saudi Arabia, not in Malaysia or China. We're happy to do business with them because they're doing the business that we want done. But not in Venezuela. Again, because Venezuela doesn't play ball, and that goes back to Chavez. The price of oil shot up in 73 with the first embargo. At that point, Venezuela made untold billions, which the people never saw. In the 70s, you had over a million people in the hills around Caracas without any water, living in cardboard houses, no health care, no education, no hope, nothing, and yet the nation was drowning in billions and billions and billions in oil money, which all was siphoned off in corruption and went to Miami. And then the World Bank came down to restructure the debts of the company of the nation when oil prices dropped, and they took what little the poor had, and they took that away too, and they were gunning down. The so-called government was gunning down people in the streets. Let's not forget that. But we have, and we even know about it. Then Chavez tried to foment the military coup. He was arrested and decided, no, I'm going to go the democratic way, and was over to the shock and horror of the elites. He was elected president. Very much like Obama, he was the first African Indio y Negro, as he told me, president of Mexico. This is a big part of the issue. Chavez, and then followed by Maduro, these are the first black and mestizo presidents of Venezuela in 400 years. They've always been white, and racism is a gigantic part of this. Juan Guaido, who is the self-declared president, he was the Speaker of the Assembly, self-declared president, is nicely white, just the way they like it. He could never get elected if running. It is a nation with very few white people, even though they are the ones they call. In fact, they don't even call themselves Venezuelans. The white people call themselves Spaniards. They don't even recognize themselves as Venezuelans, but they don't mind controlling the nation. So obviously Trump is very happy with a white guy taking over a black nation. This is kind of like Rhodesia, you know, and we don't think of it that way, but it's a real attempt by a white minority to seize the nation. And using the temptation of turning over the oil assets to the big U.S. corporations, Chavez, unlike Saudi Arabia, by the way, nationalized all the American oil companies. Aramco, which is now Saudi Arabia's oil company, the original name was American Arabian Oil Company because it was owned by American oil companies, mainly Texaco. And the Saudis nationalized our entire oil system, but then they played ball with us geopolitically. Chavez simply required that Venezuela own 51% of all of its own oil assets. Can you imagine? 51%. That's what was going on there with Chavez. And when Chavez came in, for the first time, poor people. You go to Venezuela, and there were no shanty towns. After a few years of Chavez in office, after 5 years of Chavez in office, basically the shanty towns were wiped out. People were fed. There was, yes, oh, they talk about the Cubans coming in. Yeah, the Cuban doctors. There was a Cuban doctor in like every one of these big buildings that replaced the shanty town. You had doctors, you had education, and to some extent, a lot of the unrest in Venezuela was created by Chavez because he took very poor people and no hope, nothing, gave them opportunities and education, and now he created this huge middle class which wants jobs and benefits, which with the huge, you know, with the collapse of the price of oil was very difficult for the Maduro government to take over. Now, I know Nicolas Maduro, the president. He came and visited me in New York before he was elected, and I've spoken with him and met with him many times. I'm going to tell you right now, I think Maduro is not the best choice that Chavez made to replace himself. He's not a great leader. He's not very sophisticated. And the problem is he'll let his followers, scared poor people who are worried about losing what little they have, and as the economy is going down with the price of oil, poor people are afraid of losing what they have. Both sides are getting very brutish. I'm surprised that only about 22 people have been killed in demonstrations. Both sides are go to demonstrations with guns. And actually what's amazing to me is that Maduro's kind of kept the lid on the situation so that there isn't mass murder in the streets. But I just want to tell you, think about this. And there is corruption. Whenever you have oil, and I don't care whether it's Venezuela, Russia, Alaska, where I worked, where there's massive, massive corruption. Louisiana is one of the most corrupt governments in America as an oil state. Texas, corruption. You know, it's the oil curse. There's a lot of corruption. Chavez stopped almost all the corruption, but it's really impossible for billions of dollars to go through people's hands without kind of taking a few bucks off the top. And now that price of oil has dropped, plus the U.S. has now figured out a new tactic, and the West, whether it's Canada, which is a competing oil nation, whether it's England, we've always hated the Venezuelans and resented their takeover of their own resources. The New York Times used a reporter, Juan Ferrero, who is still reporting for the Times, who, you know, he's the one who said that Hugo Chavez resigned when he was kidnapped. He said Chavez, the New York Times reported through Ferrero, that Hugo Chavez had resigned from office because he realized how bad he was as a leader, when in fact he was kidnapped. That's the New York Times. And they applauded a military attempt to take over the nation. So this is nothing new. The elites, both Democratic Party and Republican Party, suddenly Trump is a genius by supporting this coup d'etat in Venezuela. That's what it is. And how come Trump is, the Democrats think that Trump does everything wrong except suddenly in Venezuela, Trump is a great foreign policy leader? It's because both parties are covered in oil, and it's shameful. Ferrero asked Chavez after he won the election in a landslide, re-election in a landslide, when are you going to give up power? Does anyone ask Trump, when are you going to give up power? You wait for an election, buddy. Now, and supposedly it's a dictatorship. This is what we're being told. It's a dictatorship. So question, how does Juan Guaido be handed the gavel of the leadership of the Congress? He was, you know, Speaker of the House, just like Nancy Pelosi. If there's a dictatorship, dictatorships don't normally let your opposition run Congress. They prevent that type of thing. And now we've recognized this guy as president. Imagine if the United States did not have the power it had, if it was a dependent nation, like Venezuela, on foreign trade. Imagine if because of the shutdown, you had all the European nations say, okay, well, Nancy Pelosi's president, Trump isn't president. You know what? Even Democrats would say, no, we don't think we're going to operate like that. No, you can't make Nancy Pelosi president or any of these characters as someone else that they name as president. You have to have an election, my friends, to have an elected president. So this is obviously a coup d'etat, and they're enforcing it. One way they were able to do this against Maduro and not against Chavez, they were shocked by Chavez. He created this tremendous popularity and power and solidarity among the Latin nations. And now they figured out how to chip away by having they're embargoing the state of Venezuela. Venezuela cannot survive under an embargo because the parts for the oil industry to keep it going have vanished. They can't sell their oil out to any market except basically China. And you're making it impossible for the company to operate. This is an embargo to bring down a government. An embargo is an act of war. And we have basically brought, we have an act of war against the state of Venezuela. And the Democrats aren't saying a damn thing. They're silent. That's what makes me sick. To see basically the minority white population, rich population of Venezuela, rise up for their privileges. And once again, the New York Times showing pictures of these wonderful rallies of all white people, by the way. You got to look at these demonstrations. They're white people, all right? And that's a minority. And I remember when I was there and I saw these demonstrations that were in the New York Times and on American television against Hugo Chavez. And the next day, the pro-Chavez people, who are the brown, poor people, that's most people in Venezuela, and you would have literally a demonstration 10 times the size of the white protest, and that would not be covered at all. So all I'm telling you is I've seen this film before. It's just that the U.S. is now much more able to take on Venezuela through an embargo and through figuring out how to squeeze the nation economically while the price of oil is down, and now putting in a rich white overlord over the nation against the public's wishes. This is horrific. It's a U.S. coup d'etat, the worst gunboat diplomacy of the worst order, Gary. So this is Greg Palast saying, what else can I tell you?
Since Saudi Arabia almost always takes center stage when the subject of oil is brought up, people don't realize that Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world, approximately 301 million barrels, compared to Saudi's 266 million barrels.
Yes.
So quite simply, it has to be the agenda. Can you share a little about the wealthy elite Venezuelan families that were originally tied to the oil industry and that have customarily been aligned with U.S. and the large transnational oil companies?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the problems is that while one corporation, Chevron, decided to cut a deal with the Chavez administration, the others refused to go along with even meager reforms. For example, the case of Exxon, the government imposed a 17%, just that's all, 17%. Excise tax on oil, on Chevron in the heavy oil areas, and on excuse me, on Exxon and the others, and they were only paying 1%. Now you have to understand what made that number 17% fascinating was that was the excise tax that Sarah Palin imposed on oil companies in Alaska, and yet no one says Sarah Palin is a socialist maniac trying to steal America's corporate money. But that was the charge against Chavez, and they brought him into, they brought up charges against Venezuela in international courts. The problem is the white people of the white rich of Venezuela, for the most part, act as a fifth column against their own nation. They owned everything, and they don't like not owning everything. Before Chavez, they didn't pay any taxes. Chavez imposed a progressive income tax. Now, you may call that socialism, but in fact, it's more FDRism. Actually, in fact, I got to tell you, Chavez was much more FDR than Karl Marx. He wasn't that big. He liked to throw out the word socialism, but most of his reforms we would simply recognize as the New Deal. Whether it's publicly financed housing, as we have with FHA, or public education, God forbid. And the whites resented it because they owned everything. They had all the university spaces. Now suddenly black folk were taking up university spaces. So, whites hated Chavez, just hated him. And a lot of it was racial. They used to refer to him as a monkey and things like that. There's all this racial stuff, just like they did with Obama here.
Well, Greg, I appreciate you coming on and sharing these insights. You were there on the ground.
Yep.
You're telling us the firsthand, not hearsay. And I think both of us should ask the left in particular, the so-called progressives, to stand up against this, because they're not. And that's unfortunate.
Yeah, I am stunned, shocked, horrified that the so-called progressives, where is Bernie Sanders? This is a tough one. This is a tough one for the American, you know, where is Elizabeth Warren? To me, this is a real issue, not getting rid of ICE. This is really the test. If you're going to have a foreign policy, are you for oil company coup d'etats or are you for democracy? And I'd like to hear from the Democratic candidates for president, the whole pack of them, and they've all been, like, miraculously silent about Trump's coup d'etat in Venezuela, because so many of their funders have an interest in overthrowing the Venezuelan government, including, for example, John Kerry, for example, who's a billionaire. Well, let's not forget, Kerry's a billionaire from the Heinz fortune, which had big factories in Venezuela, which Chavez nationalized. And so you got a lot of rich people of both parties who will not stand up. And I don't know about the left so much as the so-called progressives of the Democratic Party. I'd like to see them stand up for democracy instead of oilocracy.
We're going to be writing each one of them a letter and asking them for their positions. Greg, we're out of time. Thank you very much. And Greg's book is The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. His website is gregpalast.com. All the best, Greg, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Gary. Bye.
We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening. Our program today goes up on the archive, What is Really Happening in Venezuela? And we'll be doing more on it on upcoming programs. Have a nice day.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother,
I can dig it.
Stop right on.
Mother, mother, there's too many of